Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Scientists say they have calculated temperatures on Earth's surface during the last ice age. The researchers made their calculations with the help of fossilized remains of ocean plankton and models of climates tens of thousands of years ago in different parts of the world. The researchers reported their findings in the British scientific publication Nature. The most recent ice age lasted from about 115,000 to 11,000 years ago. During this time, huge sheets of ice covered much of North America, South America, Europe, and Asia. The researchers said the average temperature worldwide during the height of this period, known as the last glacial maximum, was about 7.8 degrees Celsius. That average ice age temperature was about 6 degrees Celsius colder than the average today. The average world temperature during the 20th century was 14 Celsius, the scientists noted. Some areas were much colder than the average, they found. Extreme northern and southern regions cooled far more than other areas, with the Arctic region 14 degrees Celsius colder than the world average. We have a lot of data about this time period because it has been studied for so long, said Jessica Tierney in a statement. But one question science has long wanted answers to is simple. How cold was the Ice Age? Tierney helped lead the study. She is a paleoclimatologist with the University of Arizona. Tierney said that looking at information from past climates is the only way to find out what truly happens when the Earth experiences long cold or warm periods. So, by studying them, we can better constrain what to expect in the future, she said. During the Ice Age, our planet was home to large mammals such as mammoths, mastodons, woolly rhinoceros, and saber-toothed cats. These animals were able to survive in a cold climate. Early humans entered North America for the first time during the Ice Age, crossing a land bridge that once connected Siberia to Alaska, with sea levels much lower than they are today. What is interesting is that Alaska was not entirely covered with ice, Tierney said. There was an ice-free corridor that allowed humans to travel across the Bering Strait into Alaska. Central Alaska was actually not that much colder than today, so for Ice Age humans, it might have been a relatively nice place to settle. Human hunting is believed to have been partly responsible for many Earth species disappearing at the end of the Ice Age. Atmospheric carbon dioxide levels during the Ice Age were about 180 parts per million, which is very low, the researchers said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Tax officials in Africa estimate governments will collect between 10 and 30% less in taxes in 2020 because of the economic downturn. The coronavirus crisis has caused businesses in the hospitality, building, and retail industries to suffer. Yet digital companies have made plenty of money as more people stay home and carry out activities online. The situation is driving talks on the continent about how to make sure international companies like Google and Facebook can be taxed. Such companies do not always have a physical presence in countries where they earn profits. Logan Wart is Executive Secretary of the African Tax Administration Forum, or ATAF. His organization has met online to discuss these issues with government officials, the African Union, and members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. Wart said the coronavirus crisis has led to massive earnings for digital services such as e-commerce and online transactions. Profits in e-commerce are expected to increase by 41%, the ATAF says. Wart said, "Question, are we collecting better on these transactions? Are we aware of these transactions? Are the businesses doing these transactions, do they have a physical presence in our countries? And if not, do our regulations provide for them to be taxed?" Talks about how to design tax rights laws for transactions across borders are now happening within the OECD. Governments worldwide are concerned there is a conflict between places where profits are reported and places where economic activities happen. Victor Harrison leads the Economic Affairs Division in the African Union. Harrison has asked more African countries to join in the taxation talks so profits from international companies can be shared more equitably. So far, he said, just 25 African countries are involved, which is a cause for concern for the African Union. David Masondo is Deputy Minister of Finance in South Africa. He said Africa needs a central group within the African Union to speak with one voice on tax policies. These unified policies should involve or bring attention to improving the share of tax rights in cross-border transactions. That includes the digital transactions of international companies, Masondo said. The United States has pressed for its companies to be able to opt in and out of worldwide laws on taxing such companies, as long as they follow some general rules. I'm Alice Bryant.
In a recent Everyday Grammar report, we explored phrasal expressions. Phrasal expressions are groups of words that take on a special meaning. This meaning is different from what the individual words suggest. Today, we will explore three common, useful phrasal expressions. You will hear how people use them in everyday speech and in presentations, such as TED Talks.
Phrasal expressions have somewhat unusual meanings. If you look up each individual word in the dictionary, you still might not understand them as a group. Here is an example. In our earlier report, we described the phrasal expression, by the way. By the way means that the person speaking is going to introduce a new subject to a discussion. There are thousands of phrasal expressions in English. In today's report, we will explore the expressions so that, at all, and sort of.
Our first phrasal expression is so that. So that can be used in an explanation or to describe a purpose. It generally introduces a subordinate clause, a group of words with a subject and a verb. The subordinate clause plays a part in a longer sentence. Here is an example. Imagine you are explaining how to park a car on a very steep hill.
Be sure to set the emergency brake so that the car does not roll away.
The first part of the sentence, be sure to set the emergency brake, is a complete sentence. The words so that introduce a clause that explains or describes the purpose for setting the brake. Let's listen to an example of how a speaker might use so that in a presentation. In this TED Talk, Sarah Jane Dunn talks about programming cells.
And then those programs must operate in a distributed way across individual cells so that they can coordinate and that plant can grow and flourish.
Our second phrasal expression is at all. At all means to any extent or in any way. It can make statements stronger. It acts like an adverb in the sentence. Unlike so that, at all does not introduce a clause. English speakers mostly use it in the middle or at the end of a sentence. Here is an example.
Tom came to dinner last night, but he didn't eat at all. He must have been worried about something.
The reason the speaker used at all is to highlight that Tom did not eat. At all makes the statement stronger. At all is common in speaking and writing. Let's listen to how Amy Padnani, an editor at the New York Times, uses at all in a 2019 TED Talk.
There are moments when I face great self-doubt. I wondered if I was crazy or if I was all alone, if I should just give up. But when I've seen the reaction to this project, I know I'm not at all alone.
Our third phrasal expression is sort of. Sort of means in some way or to some extent. Unlike our other phrasal expressions, sort of is informal. Sort of is used in everyday speech. You will generally not see it in writing. Sort of can stand alone as a statement, as in, do you agree with that?
Sort of.
Sort of can also appear in a longer sentence, as in,
she was sort of nice.
You might hear Americans reduce sort of to something that sounds like sorta. Let's listen to how a speaker uses sort of in a presentation. In this example, John M. Chu talks about filmmaking. Listen to how he uses sort of as a kind of adverb.
You can plan, you can write scripts, you can do your storyboards, but at a certain point, your movie will speak back to you, and it's your job to listen. It's this living organism, and it sort of presents itself, so you better catch it before it slips through your hands.
I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as a revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very, very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was something that was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. It's a very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gordon says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the capital was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the capital must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.